This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Richard Heinberg, author of 10 books, including The Party's Over, Power Down, Peak Everything, and Blackout. Richard is a senior fellow of Post Carbon Institute and is widely regarded as one of the world's foremost peak oil educators and effective communicators of the urgent need to transition away from fossil fuels. Richard Heinberg is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality, published in 2011. Welcome, Richard.
Very good to be with you, Diane.
What prompted you to write your book, The End of Growth?
Well, as far back as 2008, there were clear signs that our economy was at a fundamental turning point. Some of these signs were clear within the financial sector itself, having to do with a burden of debt that we simply weren't going to be able to dig ourselves out from under. And some of it had to do with world resources and environmental impacts. I thought long and hard about all of this evidence as to whether it would actually be useful to write a book about the end of world economic growth. Obviously, there's a lot of bad news around already, and there's no point in just piling onto that unless there's a good reason to do so. But it seemed to me as though this was important for people to understand, because there are things that individuals and households, families, and communities can do to help them make this transition to a post-growth economy. And having the information, I think, is valuable. So that's why I wrote the book.
What is your definition of growth?
Yeah, the growth I'm talking about is the growth that's also talked about by economists and politicians. Effectively, the increase in GDP. GDP is gross domestic product, and it's basically just a number that represents all the money that's spent in the economy on an annual basis. And that, in turn, is a sort of marker for consumption. When economic growth occurs, we consume more. And what I'm saying in the book is that we've reached the end of that trajectory. Economic growth is something fairly recent in human history. It's just in the last century that we've seen economic growth as we've defined it in any substantial form. And we've come to believe that it's inevitable and that it will go on forever, which is kind of absurd, really, when you think about it, because, of course, we live on a finite planet, so you can't continue growing consumption forever on a finite planet. But somehow we've welded that assumption into the basics of our economic policies. And so all of our economic policies have an absurdity that's at the very core, and somehow we have to get around that, because growth, once again, is something that we just can't do forever, and things that can't go on forever come to an end at a particular time, and I think we're at that time.
What has been the importance of growth to our way of life?
Yeah, well, you know, over the course of the last century, we've depended on growth for jobs and for increase on returns in investments. It wasn't always like this. In the early part of the 20th century, we were just starting to use fossil fuels in large quantities. And that's really what made all the difference. Before the 20th century, we were relying primarily on muscle power and on agricultural crops as our major source of energy. But with fossil fuels, we had a source of energy that was so cheap and so concentrated, we could do practically anything. So we invented technologies like cars and planes to take advantage of fossil fuels. And the assembly line was a big invention along the way that helped us use fossil fuel energy just to make more stuff faster. The problem in the early part of the 20th century was we could make so much stuff so fast, there wasn't enough demand for it all. So we solved that using advertising and consumer credit. And during the course of the 20th century, as we consumed more stuff, as we talked ourselves into consuming more stuff with advertising, we went further and further in debt to pay for it all. And now at the beginning of the 21st century, we find that the scale of debt that we've created is really monstrous. And the fact is, we could go on paying for all that debt, paying off all of that debt, if we still had very rapid rates of economic growth. But other factors are intervening to cut off economic growth, and as that happens, all of those debts become due, and we don't have the growth to pay for them. So it becomes kind of a self-reinforcing feedback loop of default and contraction, and that's what we're seeing right now.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but would you underscore your key arguments that growth has ended, and ended permanently?
Sure, yeah. What I'm saying is there are three factors that are converging, and they can be summarized as debt, depletion, and disasters. Debt, I've just talked about, and we're, in effect, living at the end of the biggest credit bubble, which is a debt bubble, in the history of our species. As a result of this last century of lavish consumption fueled by oil, coal, and natural gas. But oil, coal, and natural gas are getting more expensive to produce. That's the depletion part. It's not that we're running out of oil or gas or coal, but we've finished off the low-hanging fruit. From here on, each new increment is going to be more expensive to produce and will produce less economic growth for each increment of energy. So that is increasing the cost of everything else, of transportation, of food, because, of course, we have a fossil fuel-reliant food system. It's increasing the cost of manufactured goods that have to be transported around the world. So depletion is taking its toll on economic growth. Then the disaster part of the formula refers to the environmental impacts of all of this production and consumption, especially as we're having to move to lower quality energy resources. The environmental impacts of each new increment of economic growth are that much higher. And those environmental impacts include climate change and, you know, whether or not you believe that climate change is caused by human activity, the fact is that we are seeing weird weather everywhere, record floods and droughts and fires. And the costs of these environmental disasters and industrial accidents are all increasing at a dramatic pace. In 2010, we saw a total cost of natural disasters and industrial accidents of about $220 billion. That was by far a world's record up to that time. We had floods in southern Pakistan, drought in Russia, the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. It was truly a horrible year in terms of disasters. But this year, 2011, we passed that $220 billion mark in June. Every passing year, we're setting a record. And this is causing the insurance industry enormous problems. They no longer know how to value risk. So if you project out this trajectory of increasing costs of natural disasters and industrial accidents, sometime within the next decade, we reach a point where new economic growth is overwhelmed by these costs. And if you project out those costs for several decades to come, we see virtually all GDP being negated by increasing costs of environmental disasters. So these three problems together, debt, depletion, and disasters, are converging in real time. And we're seeing the result of that in the markets, on Wall Street, in Europe, and in effect, it means the end of growth.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Richard Heinberg, author of the book, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In regard to resource depletion, you argue in your book that we will not be able to overcome limits to energy and minerals by increased efficiency or substitutions. Would you explain?
Well, standard economic theory says that whenever some resource starts to get scarce, the price goes up, and then we find a substitute that will work just as well. Well, that's the theory. How does it work in actual practice? Well, there are historic examples where substitution has worked just fine. For example, in the 19th century, when we were using whale oil for lubrication and fuel for illumination, whale oil was getting expensive because we were killing all the whales. So we transitioned to rock oil, which is better known these days as petroleum, as a source of energy and lubrication. And petroleum, or plain old oil, rock oil, turned out to be superior to whale oil in almost every sense. It was cheaper, it was more abundant, it worked better as a fuel. Substitution worked really well for us in that case. But there are situations where substitution doesn't work so well, where the substitutes are inferior or maybe even unavailable altogether. There's nothing that can take the place of a resource that is growing scarce. Well, with the resources that really matter right now, oil, coal, and natural gas, there are other energy sources that can replace them. And we have been in a national discussion now for several decades as to whether we're willing to develop those substitutes like wind, solar, geothermal, microhydro, the list goes on and on. The reality is that those substitutes are going to take time to develop. They're going to take lots of investment to develop. And in some ways, they don't really meet all the criteria that we're looking for in terms of completely replacing fossil fuels. For example, oil. The only direct substitute for oil is biofuels. And we've found over the past few years that while we can produce sizable amounts of biofuels, we can't produce enough ethanol or biodiesel to replace petroleum the way we're using it right now. And those substitutes have some serious drawbacks. They require the use of land and water. They entail topsoil erosion. We're effectively taking food out of the mouths of people to put gas in the tanks of our cars. So that direct substitute doesn't work so well. So now we're talking about substituting petroleum with electricity, with electric cars. Well, that has some drawbacks, too. It's going to take a long time. Electric cars are more expensive and so on. So, yes, there are substitutes, and we will be using them as we transition away from fossil fuels, as we deal with the end of economic growth. But those substitutes are not going to deliver economic growth the way cheap, abundant fossil fuels did in the early 20th century.
What will be the key challenges or constraints in a post-growth world?
Well, you know, when I went into writing this book, I had experience in the field of resource depletion. I had written several books on that subject. And my assumption was that it would be resource depletion that would gradually be choking off economic growth. And it would be a process that would take years, perhaps decades, and we would have a fairly long time to adapt. In the process of researching the book, and I spoke with retired people, senior people on Wall Street, a former managing director of J.P. Morgan, several hedge fund managers, and assorted economists, and so on, I learned how really the weak link in the chain is not resources, it's not energy, although those are decisive over the longer term. The real weak link is our financial system, because if the economy starts to slow down as a result of some of these other factors, then it can seize up very rapidly, and we can see a currency collapse or a collapse in the credit markets or the bond markets over the course of weeks or even days that can bring the entire world economy to its knees. We nearly saw that in the fall of 2008. And we may be headed back in the same direction right now as a result of the European debt crisis. This is really the Achilles heel of our modern economic system. You know, there are deeper flaws having to do with the fact that we have become so dependent on the ever-increasing extraction of non-renewable resources. That's clearly a profound and deep flaw at the heart of our economic system. But as that system starts to shudder and shake, people are not going to be thinking about depletion and disasters as the immediate cause of their problems. They will be looking to the financial system and the soaring unemployment rates, the failure of banks, the serial defaults of sovereign countries around the world. That's what's going to grab and hold people's attention, and they will probably fail to understand the deeper systemic problems that are bringing growth to an end.
Would you say more about how this will actually play out, politically and otherwise?
Right. Well, it's impossible to say in any detail because there are just too many balls in the air. As I alluded to, we have a very serious situation right now with regard to the European debt crisis, the Greek tragedy, as it's being called. It's very unlikely that Greece will be able to avoid a national default, and it's unclear what that will lead to at this point. It could lead to serious problems with the European banks that hold that Greek debt, particularly banks in France. And that could, in turn, spread to banks here in the U.S. and elsewhere. Clearly, there's enormous effort being expended right now at all levels, both here in the U.S. and in Europe, to prevent that from happening, to shore up the banks prior to Greece's default. But even if that does not occur, there are other problems waiting in the wings. U.S. banks still have lots of so-called toxic assets on their books. You know, when we had this big real estate bubble in the last decade, that was accompanied by homeowners taking on second mortgages and home equity lines of credit based on the inflated values of their houses. Now that those values have plummeted, the value of all of that debt has also plummeted. However, banks have yet to mark the value of that debt, of those loans, to their real market value. And so the U.S. banks are still in a process of what could be called extend and pretend. Once the chickens come home to roost, and at some point it's inevitable that those toxic assets will have to be marked to market, they will have to see the light of day. When that happens, then we're in for another bout of serious economic problems in this country. And that could happen literally any time. So we have sort of a line of dominoes stretched out in front of us, and it's impossible to say exactly when the next one is going to fall. But I think what can be said with some assurance is that we are in the early stages of another depression, at least as bad as that of the 1930s. Now, this isn't the end of the world. People survive these kinds of events. But we do have to understand that it's going to be a challenging time, and there are things that we can do to make it not as bad as it would otherwise be. And if we undertake those kinds of efforts now, then it will be much better for everyone.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Richard Heinberg, author of the book, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. What are your suggestions about the strategies that might be used to help ease the way to a healthy post-growth world economy?
Well, I think one thing that is very clear, it's by no means the only thing we have to do, but if I were to suggest just one action to our political leaders right now, it would be to get off of GDP, because everyone is promising GDP growth and it is no longer deliverable. So that means that expectations are going to be frustrated on all hands, and the electorate is not going to be happy. It doesn't matter which party is in power, no one is going to be able to deliver on their promises. They're unrealistic promises. So what we have to do is aim for what can be delivered, and that is quality of life. If we can't increase levels of consumption anymore, and I believe we can't, well, is consumption really what we want, or do we actually just want quality of life? I believe it's the latter. And I believe we can have a better quality of life without increasing consumption and without increasing debt. By quality of life, I mean levels of education, levels of satisfaction in life, the quality of our environment, the integrity of our environment, the quality of our cultural lives in our communities. Now, this isn't going to happen overnight. We've spent a century aiming at GDP growth and using that as the sole index of the health of our society, of our nation, of our communities. So transitioning to quality of life indicators, sort of gross national happiness, if you will, is something that can't be done overnight. But the sooner we start that process, the better. If we can make people's experienced lives more satisfactory, then it will matter much less if we're actually having to cut back on consumption of energy and other things that we've been used to guzzling in enormous quantities.
In addition to moving away from GDP, how can governments best respond to the end of growth?
Well, you know, we do have this enormous financial problem to overcome. It's been called a debt overhang. Through consumer debt, government debt, securitization, and derivatives, we've built up a bubble of tens of trillions, and in fact, if you include derivatives, hundreds of billions of dollars in claims. But those claims are chasing a set of products and resources and labor that's much, much smaller. So that means when the merry-go-round stops, there are going to be lots and lots of claims that are not met, and that happens by way of defaults, bankruptcies, and foreclosures. We're going to see a lot of those over the course of the next decade. And if government wants to get out ahead of that, I think there are really only a couple of ways of doing that. One would be debt forgiveness. We need a kind of debt jubilee in this country and around the world. If that debt is going to be defaulted upon anyway at some point down the line, why not get it out of the way sooner rather than later and do it in an organized way so we can decide how to allocate the pain from those defaults and allocate it as fairly as possible and as painlessly as possible rather than letting it occur in a chaotic and unplanned way where in most likely instance the maximum pain will be felt. So organizing a kind of debt jubilee in whatever way is possible, I think, is one of the best things the government could do right now.
What can individuals and communities do to protect themselves and adapt to the end of growth?
Yes, good question. Well, you know, if we have less consumption in our future, and I believe we do, that means we can adapt best by getting out ahead of necessity and learning how to live with less now. And there's a bit of irony in that suggestion because, of course, if everybody were to follow my advice, that would cause the economy to contract even faster, given the fact that our economy depends on consumer spending so much. Nevertheless, given the direction in which we're headed, I think personal economic self-defense requires us to learn how to consume less, to produce more for ourselves and for our families and for our neighbors. And that means growing gardens in our backyards, keeping chickens, and sharing the surplus with our neighbors, getting to know our neighbors, building up those bonds of mutual aid that are the real basis of any healthy community. And we've let those bonds sort of fall apart over the past few decades as we've moved out into anonymous suburbs and sort of depended on the automobile as our means of social interaction. Well, as that changes, we're going to need to know our neighbors, and we're going to need to be able to trust our neighbors and rely on them. The only way that's going to happen is if we start building those bonds of trust right now.
What most stands in the way of taking the steps to make a smooth transition to the end of growth?
Well, you know, a lot of things stand in our way. Habit, the expectations that we've built up over the past number of years. And frankly, I don't think that our political and economic leaders are helping very much because they're just trying to patch up the old system that's coming apart at the seams. They don't understand that a new system is needed, and they're not helping us understand what we need to do to adapt to our new economic reality. So, yeah, there are a lot of things that are standing in our way. And again, that's really why I wrote the book, is to help people arm themselves with knowledge and understanding so they can take some of these steps and see their way through what otherwise looks like a pretty dreary time ahead of us.
Did your own perspective change while writing the book?
Oh, yes, very much so. As I said earlier, I came to appreciate the importance of the financial sphere and the vulnerabilities in our financial system right now. And as a result of writing the book, I find myself reading the financial pages much more closely these days, and especially all the discussion about the Greek debt crisis.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, the message I would like to leave folks with is, yes, this is depressing news, I know, but life can be better without economic growth. And I say that with some assurance because we live 99.9% of our existence as a species without economic growth. And so we know it can be done, and we know that life can be perfectly satisfactory without the kind of rapid growth that we've become accustomed to. It's just a matter of adapting our expectations and living it within the means of the planet that we inhabit.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Richard.
It's been a pleasure, Diane. Thank you.
You have just been listening to Richard Heinberg, author of the book, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality, published in 2011 by New Society Publishers. For more information, check on the web at richardheinberg.com. Again, that's Richard, H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the Streaming Archives section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.